So one of the things that I'm amazed at, and I know you're amazed at this as well, is when you see people in your life who have very difficult circumstances, but instead of getting crushed by them, instead of getting overwhelmed by them, instead of even playing or becoming a victim by them, they tend to rise up and overcome them. Raise your hand if you know of somebody like that in your life. Almost all of us do. But we have some heroes in our life, people who have experienced the raw end of life, some difficulties in life, and yet they tend to be overcomers, that they tend to be those who rise above them. And the question that I want you and I to wrestle with this morning and then next week is how? How do people tend to do that? Because the reality is that all of us experience the raw end of life at times. All of us experience very difficult scenarios in life. And so as we look at those around us who are our spiritual and relational heroes, who tend to rise above them and handle their problems with grace and truth, we got to learn, how do they do that? How do they approach their life in such a way, how do they approach God in such a way that they are overcomers? And as you guys would guess, because it's obvious to our Christian faith, there are plenty of people in the Bible that teach us about this. People like Paul and Timothy and David and obviously Jesus, Moses. People in the Bible who have risen above their circumstances and show us through their lives how we can be overcomers as well. And one of the guys in the Old Testament that I mentioned before I prayed that can truly help us when it comes to learning some of the secrets of how to respond to difficulty in life is an Old Testament character by the name of Job. Job. Let me tell you a little bit about him and the book in the Bible which tells us his story. The book of Job obviously is an Old Testament book written very early on in the history of the Bible, sometime before Moses and even the beginning of the Israelite nation. Most likely during the time of the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, in the book of Genesis, or during that time. The story takes place, it tells us, in the land of Uz, almost surely outside of Israel, either in Edom or Aram. And what you need to know more than anything else is that Job was a very prosperous man, very, very wealthy, but also very godly and very righteous. He was the quintessential Christian businessman. So look up here on the screen. It says in the opening words of Job in chapter 1, verses 2 and 3, this. It says, there were born to him, Job, 7 sons and 3 daughters. He possessed 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, and 500 female donkeys, and very many servants, so that this man was the greatest of all the people of the East. So he was kind of like the Bill Gates or the Warren Buffett of his day, but with godliness attached. That was Job back then. And there are essentially 3 movements to the story of Job. Very quickly, 3 parts to this book. There's the movement in the first 2 chapters where they introduce Job and then engage in what we call the heavenly wager. I'll get to that in a second. And then for the next 34 chapters, there is a dialogue between Job and his 3 so-called friends about why the difficulty that Job has experienced has happened to him. And then in the last few chapters of the book, beginning in chapter 38, God speaks to Job. He shows up on the scene and he sets the record straight as to who he is and who Job is. Those are the 3 movements of this book. The introduction to Heavenly Wager, the dialogue, and then God showing up on the scene. Now, to understand the story of Job, you do need to understand at least the first 2 chapters right now, and that is what I call the heavenly wager. You see, the book begins with God and Satan talking, and Satan gives God a challenge. He basically says, you got this guy named Job, and I'm telling you, God, the only reason he remains faithful to you is because he's blessed. He's got money, he's got his health, he's got a great family, he's got a robust spirituality. And I'm telling you, if he didn't have any of that, he would not be faithful and true to you. And God says, that's not true. Try him and you will see. And so the first wave of attack comes on Job. And as you guys know, all that he has is taken away from him. His sons, his daughters, his servants, his animals. It happens through natural process, through marauding bands and natural catastrophes. But we know who is behind it. And everything is gone except his wife. and Job stays faithful and true. But it's not done yet. There's a further challenge by Satan, and Satan says to God, yeah, you know what, I took everything from him, but he still got his health. And if you have your health, you have everything. And so obviously this guy is only staying faithful and true to you because he has his health. And God says, have at it. And so Satan afflicts Job with sores and a terrible disease all over his body. Some experts think it's leprosy. And so Job is just afflicted with this terrible disease, and yet he stays faithful and true. And at the end of chapter 2, we find Job penniless, diseased, distraught, an absolute mess, having lost everything of earthly value, even his health. The only thing that he has is his wife, and she wasn't much help. And I'm not being mean to her, it's just that the text kind of connotes that she wasn't very helpful. She was even more of a mess as a result of all of this than him. And then we enter into the second phase, the 34-chapter dialogue between Job and his so-called friends, because he has friends that are going to try to help him understand why all this has happened to him, and yet they're not going to be very helpful. We'll get to that in a second. And then, as we'll parse that a little bit more next week, God shows up on the scene. Now, you're going to want to dial into this. Many people see the book of Job as dealing with the problem of evil. Why God would allow human suffering, why God would allow Job to suffer. But what is most fascinating about this book, and I've read it numerous times, is that it never answers this question or issue at all. In other words, it never tells us why God allowed Job to suffer. And so it doesn't answer the question as to why you and I experience suffering as well. Don't get me wrong. There is a lot of discussion in this book as to why Job has had to suffer, especially in the middle section between him and his three friends. But when God shows up on the scene toward the end of the book, he himself does not directly answer Job as to why these bad things have happened to him, and so he never answers it consequently for you and me. No, this story is actually more about something else, something that I would argue is more helpful, more life-giving in the midst of our pain, something that can help us deal significantly with the problems and obstacles that we have in our life. This book gives us some truisms about this life, some truisms about God, some truisms about our spiritual and relational lives that we can grab onto and believe that will help us in the midst of our own difficulties. So three things we learn from Job about life. I'm calling this life in a nutshell, and how God fits into all of it. Three things that you and I need to fiercely and firmly believe if we're ever going to handle our life problems with grace and truth. And the first thing that we need to establish, and this is point one on your outline, we're going to get to points two and three next week, is this. And that is that life is filled with circumstances that are not fair. I know many of you know this, but we got to break this down. I know I've talked to you about this before, but never from Job. Life is filled with circumstances that at the end of the day, no matter how you parse them out, are absolutely not fair. And now, to fully understand this, I want you to notice me a couple of key things about the story of Job, because this will help you see why this book really does teach us this. First, notice with me that Job is described by God himself and even by those around him as blameless. Blameless. Look at Job 1, verse 8, and then chapter 2, verse 3. Look up here on the screen. Look at what God says about Job. It says, "And the Lord said to Satan, have you considered my servant Job? There's nothing like him on earth. Here it is, a blameless and upright man who fears God and turns away from evil. And the Lord said to Satan, have you considered my servant Job? There's none like him on earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and turns away from evil. He still holds fast his integrity, although you incited me against him to destroy him without reason." Folks, that word blameless there literally means undefiled, complete, or upright. It doesn't mean perfect, because in chapter 7, verse 21, Job admits that he's a sinner and has transgression in his life. So it can't mean that. No, what this word means is that Job has more integrity, relatively speaking, than anybody else God knew, and that he has a degree of godliness that's way above the norm. that when it comes to those around him on planet Earth, he was like the Mother Teresa, the Billy Graham of his generation. High integrity, everybody saw it, everybody honored it, including God. He stood a head higher than most around him, a blameless man, humanly speaking. Now, as you're hanging on to that, notice secondly in the story that calamity and suffering then came upon Job, and here's the key, for no reason due to something he had done or not done. This is very important for you to see. It says in chapter 2, verse 3, that all of this came upon Job, did you catch it? Without reason. Without reason. And though we know, because we see behind the scenes, the narrator telling us what's going on here, that if there was a reason, it was this bet between God and Satan, Job doesn't know that. And even if he did, there still would be no earthly reason for all this bad stuff to happen to Job. Why? Go back to point one, because he was blameless. And so I would submit to you that what happened to Job here, by anybody's definition, was not fair. He was an upright guy, doing all the right things he knew to do, and yet all of this calamity came upon him, and there was no reason, the scriptures say, that this should have happened to him. He didn't deserve any of it, and he didn't know why this was happening to him. In fact, quite the opposite. He probably deserved blessing for his blameless life, blessing for all the good that he had done, but it doesn't come. And what you need to know is that Job is aware of this aspect of his story. Look at what he says at one point to one of his friends who is accusing him of doing wrong, and that's why all this had happened to him. Look at how Job responds in Job chapter 6, verses 24 through 30. See if you can pick up on what he's saying. He says, "Teach me, and I will be silent. Make me understand how I have gone astray. How forceful are upright words, but what does reproof from you reprove? Do you think you can reprove words when the speech of a despairing man is wind? You would even cast lots over the fatherless and bargain over your friend. But now be pleased to look at me, for I will not lie to your face. Please turn, let no injustice be done. Turn now, my vindication is at stake. Is there any injustice on my tongue? Cannot my palate discern the cause of calamity?" In a very real way, folks, he is saying, I've done nothing wrong. I haven't done anything to warrant these awful circumstances that I find myself in, and none of this is fair or right. Please see this, folks. It's very important for where we're going this morning. What happened to Job was and is not fair by anybody's definition. Ergo, what this book teaches us is that life is filled with circumstances, Job-like circumstances, that are not always fair. Bad things do happen to good people, and bad things do happen to God's people. And here's what most Christians don't understand, is that many times we don't know the reason why they happen, and we never will. I mean, if I had a dime for sometimes when a Christian's going through our times, that they say to me, well, there must be a reason, and I guess I'll find out. I sit there and think to myself, I don't say it because it's cruel, but I think to myself, no, you probably never will. You've experienced the raw end of a fallen world, and the narrator's not even telling you whether there's a bet between God and Satan going on in your life. And so like Job, you're experiencing the unfairness of life, and you might never know why. Why? Because life is unfair. It's a staple in a fallen world. And so let's think of some scenarios. Another person receives a job promotion that you should have gotten. Is that fair? No, it's not. A person is born with gifts and talents that allow them to breeze into a lucrative career while you struggle for every mediocre accomplishment. Is that fair? No, it's not. One of my best friends, Pastor Tom Schrader, he gets up at 5 o'clock in the morning on the Sunday that he is to preach in front of thousands of people, and he honestly says to himself, "What should I talk about today?" And he opens up his Bible, and he has a devotional, and then he gets up in front of thousands of people, and he wows them with his teaching of the Word of God. And I sit there and go, that stinks. I spent 20, 25 hours preparing for a 140-minute sermon, agonizing over every word, every illustration. I'll explain every point, because I'm not that good. If you just ask me to get up here and talk off the top of my head, I'm telling you, you all are going to be bored out of your mind. There's guys out there that are so much more gifted than me. Is that fair? No. Athletes and entertainers are paid millions of dollars each year to help us escape, while most school teachers and educators who are paid to help our kids understand reality are paid barely livable wages. Is that fair? No. How about this one? A friend of mine in London, Ontario, he's about 55. He's a runner. He's eaten right all of his life. We used to go out to eat, and I'd have Wendy's, and he'd have a salad. And tragically, he just got cancer, stomach cancer, and it's stage 4 metastasized, and he's going to be home with the Lord fairly soon. And yet there's going to be another person who doesn't eat or run like my friend Mike, and he's going to eat Wendy's all of his life, live till 90, and die immediately of a heart attack. Is that fair? No, that's not fair at all. I mean, think of the headlines of just this last year. Unemployment is still at high levels, while plenty of decent people want to work. Tornadoes have whipped through the Midwest and destroyed people's lives in 5 minutes. Firefighters have been killed fighting people's fires to help protect their homes. Is any of that fair? The Cubs have not won a pennant in 104 years. I mean, I know that's funny, but think about that. What baseball team have not won a pennant in 104 years? And the chances of them winning one in my lifetime are very, very small. See, here's what I'm trying to hammer home. Life is not fair. That we have to agree upon. And we don't always know why. What the Bible tells us is that a sinful and fallen world that we live in goes against the grain of fairness every chance that it gets. And there's many times that you and I can do very little about it. I'm not suggesting that we don't fight for justice. I'll comment on that in a second here. But the reality is, even with all of our fighting, have you ever noticed? It's still unfair. And unfair things happen to you and I all the time. And so what do we do with this? I mean, other than depressing us with this point, Jamie, what do we do with this bit of biblical and experiential knowledge that life is filled with circumstances that are not fair? And this is a good question to ask. It really is. I think this is a $10 question to ask, is that once you and I honestly admit that there will be difficulties in life beyond our control, and even difficulties in life that we can't control, what do we internally, spiritually do with these things? And there are really two choices, two pathways that we can choose in life when it comes to understanding that life is not fair. And the first one is this: we can demand and expect for life to be fair. In other words, we can believe that life should be fair and fight with everything in us to demand and expect it to be fairer and more kinder than it really is. And before you dismiss this, this is what many, many people do, and quite frankly, many Christians do this as well. And this is what Job's three friends were all about. I mean, they totally believed that life should be fair. And they governed their thinking and their lives around this theology. They functioned with what psychologists would call a reward-punishment motif. That life is filled with being rewarded if you do good, punishment if you do bad. Biblically speaking, they functioned with what we call a reap-what-you-sow mentality. That if you have a circumstance in life, you must have deserved it because you reap what you sow. And though the Bible does say that we reap what we sow, it never says it absolutely, like that's true in every single circumstance in life. But Job's friends believe this absolutely. So look at how one of his friends puts this in trying to help Job understand what was happening to him. Look at Job 8, verses 3 through 6. This is very revealing. He says, "Does God pervert justice, or does the Almighty pervert what is right? If your children have sinned against him, he has delivered them into the hand of their transgression." In other words, your children died because they must have sinned. "If you will seek God and plead with the Almighty for mercy, you are pure. If you are pure and upright, then surely he will arouse himself for you and restore your rightful habitation." You ever known somebody like this? That means he's saying to Job, "Hey, Job, obviously there's something wrong and sinful about your life. You know, you're blameless, and I know God sees that, but obviously there's something here that you haven't recognized, something about your life that is still wrong and sinful. And if you would just recognize that, then because you sow what you reap, or you reap what you sow, then obviously your circumstances would get better. The only problem is that this is patently false when it comes to Job. You see, Job's friends demanded and expected that life be fair, and they based their entire worldview upon that. And the point is, so do many people today, even many well-meaning and good-hearted followers of Christ. They choose door number one here, and they expect and demand that life should be fair, and they govern their emotions, their expectations, their relationships, even their walk with God upon this idea that life should be fair. And you know what happens when we do that? You know what happens when we demand that life be tit for tat, that it be fair, and that everything you do should have a fair outcome? You know what happens when we do that? Two things happen. Tell me if this isn't true. The first thing that happens is that with other people around them, they become hard, tough, and callous, and this puts a huge distance between them and those around them. In other words, if your mindset is like Job's friends, then when somebody around you is going through a difficult time, you're obviously going to have to think, well, they must have done something to deserve that. There's no other explanation. You see a street kid, and you think to yourself, I wonder what that kid did to end up on the street. Your friend tells you that their kids are on drugs, and you think to yourself, I wonder what kind of bad parenting they had that their kids ended up on drugs. Or your friend tells you that they lost their job because of downsizing at work, and your immediate thought is, I'll bet you they didn't downsize. I'll bet you they did something to deserve that. Do you know Christians that think like that? I do. But we are the most judgmental and harsh people on planet Earth, and part of it is because of this theology in which we say, like Job's friends, that obviously if somebody's going through something wrong, they must have done something wrong to deserve that. And conversely, if they're going through something that's good and right, they must have done something right. And so we carry this ethic into all of our relationships, that life should be fair, and that if you do the right things will happen to you. And need I tell you that not only is this not true, but this is hardly a friendship-building and intimacy-producing thing to bring into your relationships. Because the reality is that if you do that, people are going to see you as a non-grace-filled person who doesn't have a very good take on reality, and they're not going to want to be around you. But then, interestingly, and this is the second thing I've noticed, is that when it comes to ourselves, however, when you're like this, when you have this theology, when it comes to ourselves, we're the exact opposite. Have you ever noticed that? In other words, instead of being harsh and judgmental on ourselves, when we go through difficult times, we tend to feel pity for ourselves, sorry for ourselves. We feel defeated and discouraged, and we become victims. I see that all the time. People that have the theology that life should be fair, when it's not fair to them, what do? They go, why is this happening to me? This shouldn't be happening to me. I've done good. I've done right. You never say that about your neighbor, but you say that about yourself. I've done good. I've done right. And because I've done good and right, then this shouldn't be happening to me. This is not fair. And we become a victim. I like how Richard Carlson, in his book, Don't Sweat the Small Stuff, and It's All Small Stuff, says it like this. Look up here on the screen. He says, when we don't recognize or admit that life isn't fair, we tend to feel pity for ourselves. Pity, of course, is a self-defeating emotion that does nothing for anyone except to make everyone feel worse than they already do. So please see, either way we lose. We're too hard with others, we're too soft with ourselves, so we create distance with others, and we have increased feelings of discouragement and defeat with ourselves, all because of really bad theology that doesn't understand one of the key messages of Job, and that is that life is not fair. And I know what some of you are thinking right now. You're thinking, but Jamie, I get this. I'm 55 years old, and I've been knowing this all my life. I know that life isn't fair. But you see, here's the problem, is that you know it here, but you really don't believe it here. You really don't walk around. You don't wake up every day and say, some bad things are going to happen to me today, and my first response better be that life isn't fair. You really don't think that way. Charles Sykes is the author of the book, came out in the 90s, called Dumbing Down Our Kids. It's a book about raising our kids in what he calls, and I quote, our liberal, feel-good, politically correct culture. And in this book, interestingly, he cites that the average teenager uses the phrase, "it's not fair," 8.6 times a day. Now that shouldn't surprise any of us, right? I mean, when I was a teenager, I used the phrase, "life is not fair," 8 times before breakfast, because I just assumed that life should be fair. But the reality is that he says the average teenager 8.6 times a day, but then he goes on to say that before we get too down on our kids, we got to ask ourselves, where did they learn this from? And the reality is they learned it from us, because we're a bunch of adult children walking around still demanding before God that life be fair and that life work for us. And if it doesn't work and it's not fair, then obviously somebody's done something wrong, and it's either us or, as we'll see next week, we even doubt the goodness of God and say maybe God is not fair. And again, don't get me wrong, I am not suggesting that we don't fight for justice. Don't take that away from this. I'm simply saying that when things are beyond our control, when in our personal lives we get the raw end of life, one of the things that will help take the edge off it is if you firmly and truly believe that life is not fair. Because here's the second thing that we can choose in light of all of this, and with this will be done, and that is that we can choose to accept the fact that life will not be fair all the time. We accept rather than demand. We expect that life not be fair rather than the other way around. I got to tell you, folks, I really do live this. I mean, I've had a rough history with this truism that I keep bringing us back to, that life is not fair, because when I was growing up, I really did demand that life be fair. But one of the reasons that I fit well in a Scottsdale context is because the little hometown that I just spent a month in that I grew up in was an upper middle class town. My dad was a successful lawyer, and so I wasn't raised with a silver spoon in my mouth, but I was raised in a really good environment. And when you're raised in a really good environment, I like how Tim Kimmel says it, the problem with being raised in a really good environment like that is that you're born on third base, but you think you've hit a triple. And the reality is that you haven't. I mean, isn't that true about Scottsdale kids? It was true about me growing up. I was born on third base, but I really thought I had hit a triple. And the reality is I wasn't. I was just born on third base. And so growing up, I really was kind of spoiled, and I expected life to be fair. I remember my very first experience with this was when I was in first grade. I can remember this like it was yesterday, and I'm almost 50. I was in first grade, a little suburb outside of Cleveland, and I'd been given a basketball for my birthday. Now, little do we all know that I would not be very tall, and so basketball would not be my sport, but they didn't know it back then. I loved this basketball. And do y'all remember what show and tell was at school? So I was going to show and tell, and I'm walking to school. This is before the day of buses. I'm walking to school with my brand new basketball. I'm so proud, and a kid pushed me. One of the second graders pushed me, and that was okay. I got pushed around a lot, and the basketball went out into the road, and you know what happened? A car came by and popped my brand new basketball. And there I am looking at it like Calvin and Hobbes. I'm like looking at this little thing, and I'm just thinking to myself, my basketball just got killed. And my immediate thought, I kid you not, I can remember like yesterday, was, well, that's okay. Dad will buy me a new one. I mean, it's not my fault that the basketball got popped, and it was my only birthday present. So obviously, when I tell my dad this, he's going to replace it. So I went home that night, and I showed my dad the pop basketball, and my dad said, wow, that's really a bummer. And I said, yeah, my basketball's gone. And I said, so when do I get a new one? And I'll never forget, he looked at me, and I can still see him saying this. I mean, it was like Satan. He looked at me, and he said, maybe next year on your birthday, you can get another basketball. I was speechless. I didn't say life's not fair by then. I started that like third grade. But by that point, I was like going, you're kidding. I mean, I'm not going to get a new basketball? I was like dumbfounded. And that started my whole relationship with beginning to say life is not fair. All growing up, I would say life is not fair. In my first pastorate, I can remember when bad things would happen and when people would misunderstand me and people would get in my way and not embrace the ministry that I wanted to do or whatever. I remember thinking to myself, this is not fair. This is not fair. Who are these people to get in my way? This is not fair at all. Kim and I would go through difficult times in our marriage in which she wouldn't understand the wonderful guy that I am. And I remember thinking to myself, this is not fair. This is not right. My kids would start to act out when they were, 18 months old or something like that. And I remember thinking, you need to listen to me. This is not fair. And it was about 15 years ago, honestly, when I was about 35, pathetically speaking, that I started to grow up. And I started to wake up every day and say, you know what, I better make peace with this thing. And I better start to realize that life is not fair. So you know what I do now? And honestly, I really practice this. Is that I'm now almost 50. My kids are 23, 21, and 19. And even this summer, my kids did not respond to certain things. I can't break any confidence, but they didn't respond to certain things the way that I thought they should. Can any of you relate to that? And so, you know, they made decisions, bonehead decisions, that I just thought might even carry some long-term consequences, and you're not doing it the way I should. 10 years ago, I would have been like going to God just saying, this is not fair. And the reason I would do that, by the way, is because Kim and I have been awesome parents. I really mean that. We didn't have Christian parents. We read all the books. We've done the right things. We prayed for them in the crib. We've taken them to church. We went on their vacations. We went to every sporting event. We have given them good ethics. We put them in a Christian school. We've been there. You can tell my anger. We have been there for them. We have loved them. We have sacrificed so much for them. And then they go ahead and make these decisions, and I sit there and go, that's not, but I don't expect life to be fair anymore. See, they don't owe me that. We're going to talk about that next week. They don't owe me that. They're adults. They're going to make their own decisions. I apply this to my church. Before I left, I had to put out some fires right before I left that almost caused me to want to stay in Cleveland. And there were some people here in our church based on some decisions that I had made. Pat knows what I'm talking about. And they didn't like my decisions. Now, here's the problem with decisions when your pastor makes a decision. He obviously makes them because he thinks he's right. I don't say that arrogantly. It's just that what idiot would make a decision when he thinks he's wrong? You'd have to be dumb to do that. So every decision I make, just let me go on record saying, I make it because I've been thoughtful, prayerful, sought wise counsel, and at the end of the day, I probably think it's the best thing for our church if we do this. The only problem is that in a church this size, when you do that, there's obviously people who don't understand. They haven't gone to counseling skills training class and learned how to empathize or learned how to do reflective listening. And so they write me vitriolic emails telling me I'm an idiot and that I'm motivated by Satan based on the decision that I made. And that's hard to take. And I'm not kidding you. People, I mean, they basically say, how could you be so evil? And there's times where I sit there and I look at these emails and I can't even respond. They're so unfair. But I don't expect life to be fair. I really don't. I wake up and say, I get it. Today, there's probably going to be some things happening to me that aren't fair. And I'm going to fight for justice. I'm not going to stop doing that. But I many times won't win because life is not fair. I went on this vacation knowing that I'd gained 20 pounds since I came to Scottsdale Bible Church. 20 pounds. That picture out there in the foyer, 20 pounds. I'm heavier. And it's killing me. It really is. And so honestly, it's a true story. For the last month, I did the diet that 10 years ago would have dropped 20 pounds. And it did nothing. Now let me ask a question. Is that fair? I said to Kim, what's going on with that? She said, you're almost 50, loser. It's not going to work anymore. I was like, this is just wrong. This is wrong. I realized life's not going to be fair. You see, when are we going to grow up and realize that by demanding that life be fair, it's just going to make us miserable? Honestly, I'm having fun with this. I wake up every day and I'll say, I can't wait to see what injustice is going to hit me today. And most importantly, how well I take it. Amen? We're going to talk next week about how well we take it with God. I know I haven't brought God into the picture yet. We're just setting things up. Next week, when we continue on in Job, we're going to talk about how it happens when God shows up on the scene and how God makes all the difference in us applying this idea of life not being fair. But for this week, I just want you to chew on this. How well are you doing with this? When you, something happens to you each day, small or big, do you demand that life be fair? Or are you becoming more at peace with the reality that you live in a fallen world and that bad things even do happen to God's people? And he still loves you, as we'll see next week. And he's still involved in your life. But there will be times it's not fair. Let's go to the table and pray. Father, I thank you for your goodness and for your grace, for all that you do for us and letting us know the realities of life and even how we can weather the storms of life. And so I pray, Father, that as some of us are dealing with some very significant things here this morning, that you do is just cement good theology, a right view of this world, and just say that it's not fair. And sometimes we don't even know why. Job teaches us that. And I thank you, Lord, for his faithful testimony. I pray as we go to the table right now, Lord, talk about unfair. The Son of God, the second person of the Trinity, coming to this earth, dying a brutal death on our behalf so that we might be forgiven and come to know you. I thank you, Lord, for the unfairness of the cross that shows us the grace that you've given us in Christ. May we celebrate that at this table, I pray. In Jesus' holy and precious name, amen.